Well, good morning and good afternoon, everyone. I'm Elliot Callan, president of Prosperity Financial Group, and I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Meet the Expert. Today, we've got an interesting niche concept here, maybe not a concept, but a program on women's empowerment for women called Be Prepared and Be Empowered. And so we've got Leslie Geller here. Leslie is both an attorney with a master's in taxation from NYU. That's the same school my brother went to. And she's going to be talking today about empowerment for women. We know that women control about 51% of all the assets in this country. That's a growing number. That's not a shrinking number. That's going to continue to grow. And so in the financial industry, if we're not embracing that concept, we're not going to have clients at the end of the day. So Leslie, I'd like to welcome you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Great. I'm going to turn the show over to you and we'll come back and I have a few questions for you when we're all done.
Perfect. I'm just going to share my screen and let's start with some statistics here. There we go. Okay. So women's life expectancy is on average 5 years longer than men's. These are all statistics that everyone is familiar with, I'm sure, on the call. 59 years is the median age of widowhood. Women spend on average 10 years alone after the death of their spouses, and half of marriages end in divorce. And of those divorces, 69% are initiated by women. So what does this mean? All women should expect to be solely responsible for their financial well-being at some point in their lifetimes, whether because of death or divorce. But many married women are not acting accordingly. Although they often handle the day-to-day financial matters like budgeting, paying bills, the majority of married women are not similarly involved in the larger, more macro financial matters, right? Like financial planning and investing. So here's some really startling statistics from a UBS study from a couple of years ago. 56% of women deferred to a spouse on investment and financial planning, and even more millennials, so 61%. I was incredibly surprised by that number. 43% of female breadwinners defer to their spouses on major financial decisions, so a little bit less than the general population surveyed, but still significantly high. And more than three quarters of the women polled were happy with this division of labor when it came to finances. So these are really powerful data points, but the impact of them, I think, is amplified if you put them into context by considering the demographic situations among women. So because women outlive men, generally, because historically women have had less involvement in those big financial decisions, and because it's more common for women to have absences from the workforce, right? Maternity leave, caring for an elderly family member. So they have a different distribution of income across lifetime. Women really do have a unique set of needs when it comes to financial planning and guidance. But what is the best way to address these needs? I'm sure so many of us listening right now have heard different approaches to the ways women should be dealing, addressing their finances. But we really believe that the answer here is just simply information. So helping women investors get the information they need to be better prepared and make the right financial decisions for their future. So we're really reticent to generalize 52% of the population as one monolithic group, right? We've all seen instances of that. This perpetuates stereotypes. So we believe that this approach, right, helping women uncover the types of information they need to feel more prepared and what type of information that is, really varies among investors and specific client situations. So today, what I'm going to do is walk you through a case study of a hypothetical client named Anne to demonstrate the types of foundational information women investors should be seeking out. So, and a big caveat here, and if you take away anything from our time together, it's that this information isn't just helpful to women and doesn't just apply to women, right? Because of, you know, our societal norms, because of, you know, gender norms, it often creates problems for women. but this information is incredibly helpful no matter your gender. So let's start with Anne. This is Anne. Anne and her husband Joe are reviewing their financial plan. They have meetings scheduled with their accountant, financial advisor, and estate planning attorney. Here's some details about Anne. She's in her early 60s. She's financially comfortable. She's a marketing executive. When her father died, he left her an inheritance and a trust for her benefit. She and Joe are married. They've been married for 20 years. It's their second marriage. They do not have children together, but they both have children from their first marriage. Joe is part owner and operator of a successful small business. And like the women represented in the statistics we just discussed, although Anne likes to stay informed on financial matters, Joe has traditionally managed their relationships. He's been the key point person in their family for the estate planning attorney, the financial advisor, and the tax professional. So Anne and Joe have a solid relationship, and everyone in their blended family gets along well, right? It's the best possible situation. And I'm sure we've all encountered the opposite, but this is a pretty good situation. However, Anne is concerned about what would happen to her and their family in the event of a divorce or Joe's death, particularly if it happens prematurely. Anne really wants to take this opportunity while they're reviewing their financial plan and their estate plan to educate herself and get up to speed on their family financial situation, and really to understand what her rights and obligations would be upon a divorce or Joe's death when it comes to their property. Anne knows from all of the horror stories she's heard from friends and family that the key to avoiding all of the potential pitfalls we hear about, right? Some of them are up here: time-consuming and expensive litigation, not having enough assets to support her lifestyle through retirement and her death, and family discord, right? Just not getting along. The key to avoiding all of those things is information. But Anne's unsure of what information she needs. She doesn't even know where to start. So today, I'm going to walk through some of Anne's biggest concerns, right? Those situations that she'd like to avoid down the road. And with each situation, we'll give Anne the questions that she should be asking of her financial advisor, of her tax professional, of her estate planning attorney, and then some of the appropriate steps she should be taking with that information. So let's start with Anne's first concern. And just to give you a little bit of context, I think this is helpful to understand. Because I was an attorney for 13 years, I dealt with a lot of women in these types of situations. So a lot of these hypothetical situations come from my personal experiences with female clients and their families. So I'll have some good stories to share along the way. So let's start with Anne's first concern: Anne's right to marital assets. So I'm going to set this up a little bit. Anne and Joe agreed when they got married that they would share equally in any assets acquired or earned during their marriage. Anne realizes, though, that she has no idea how their assets are titled, right? She doesn't know how their home is titled, how their investment accounts, and she doesn't know how that impacts her legal ownership in the case of divorce or Joe's death. Anne knows that from their last round of estate planning, Joe's will provides that a good portion of his estate upon his death goes to his children from his first marriage. That's not an unusual situation. Anne's concerned, though, that if the assets are not titled correctly, right, if these assets that they promised to share are titled in Joe's name alone, right, and not in their names jointly, that if Joe dies first, she'll have to go out of her way to prove that she has an ownership right in those assets that they agreed to share equally, right? She knows she'll be able to do that, but she doesn't even want to have to, because that can create an acrimonious situation. It can create tension within the family. She would love to not have to deal with that. So the question Anne should be asking here is, what is mine, what is Joe's, and what is ours? And this is absolutely the foundational question that should be asked when you're going through this type of financial planning process. Always the right place to start before you even start making those financial decisions is understanding who owns what, right? So not just what the couple owns, but what each of them owns individually and what their rights would be to each of the assets they own, particularly the big ones, upon a death or divorce. And the complexity here comes from the fact that there really are three major factors that impact ownership rights, right? Upon death, upon divorce. So first of all, the property law in the state where Ann and Joe resides, right? If you live in California, it's community property law. If you live in a non-community property state, it's a completely different system of laws called equitable distribution. The second thing that impacts ownership rights is title, the name in which assets are held, right? Is it held in Joe's name? Is it held in Ann's name? And the type of title, is it held as tenants in common? Is it held in joint tenants? Is it held in one individual's name or in a revocable trust for their benefit? And then finally, as if that wasn't difficult enough, the treatment. So how Ann and Joe use the assets during their marriage, right, can impact their ownership rights. So even if an account is titled in one of their names alone, if they're using that account to pay joint family expenses, that can impact the separate property nature, the non-marital property nature of that of those assets in that account. So you have three big factors that impact ownership. So it's a really complicated analysis, but I can't stress enough how important it is. So Ann really needs to understand how all three of these factors interact with respect to each other and hers and Joe's assets. And based on what she uncovers regarding any particular asset, if deemed ownership does not align with their intent, they may need to change the title, right? Adjust how they use or manage the asset or create documentation that reflects their actual intent, right? This is, as I said, one of those foundational issues that should always be at the start of the planning process. Okay, next concern. This is a corollary of the first one. So in the same way that Anne's concerned about determining who owns what, she's also concerned about who owes what, right? Debt is a big deal, just like asset ownership is as well. So Ann remembers co-signing several loan documents related to Joe's business several years ago. She also knows that because of the nature of Joe's business, he's probably incurred additional debt. Ann, like most of us, does not remember the particular terms of the notes she signed. She doesn't recall where the copies of those notes are, right? She doesn't really understand either what the extent of any additional business debt would be. And Anne's concerned, and she's right to be concerned, that she could have personal liability exposure for Joe's business debts and is particularly worried about what would happen if they got divorced or Joe died before those debts were paid off. So the question Anne should be asking, what do I owe? What do we owe? And what does Joe owe? So just like there are default property ownership rules, right? There are default rules that dictate ownership of debt. And so really to avoid any unpleasant surprises, it's important that Anne fully understand her own direct liabilities, right? So those documents that she signed with respect to direct debt, as well as potential indirect liabilities through Joe or his business. And in community property states, this is a huge, huge concern, right? Debt is just as important as ownership of assets, right? Certain debts or guarantees that are in Joe's name alone could be imputed to Ann, depending on the facts of the situation. That's a really scary prospect, but I've seen it happen, particularly in community property states. As I said, this can get very messy upon a divorce or premature death. So the ownership of debt is really just as important and maybe even more important in certain circumstances than asset ownership. And it's often even more of a nuanced issue, right? Fact specific on the client specific situation. And so it's essential that Ann have all of the facts regarding any debt that could possibly be imputed to her. So this, again, a corollary of that asset ownership issue, but this should be a foundational part of that initial discussion when you're going through that planning process. All right. Anne's next concern. So just like Anne wants to determine who owns what, right? She also wants to make sure that she fully understands what would happen to their assets upon Joe's death. So both their marital assets and Joe's separate assets. So as part of the review of their estate plan, Anne and Joe discussed that Joe's will provide that Anne receive a portion of Joe's assets upon his death, right? So some of Joe's assets go to his kids from his first marriage, some go to Anne. But Anne doesn't get those assets outright. Anne gets her share of the assets in a marital trust for Anne's benefit for the remainder of her life. And then whatever's left goes to Joe's children from his first marriage upon Anne's death. This is a very typical arrangement in a second marriage situation. So during their discussions about their estate plan, Joe mentioned that he wants his son to be the trustee of the trust for Anne's benefit. This makes Anne a little nervous because although she has a good relationship with her stepson, she's concerned that anytime she wants distribution from the trust, she'll be required to ask her stepson. And he'll also be permitted to sell any assets held in the trust without her consent if he's the trustee, right? Also, her stepson is the remainder men of the trust. So whatever's left at the end goes to him and his siblings. So that creates what could be a difficult dynamic when it comes to making decisions about distributions for Anne, who is his stepmother. So the question Anne should be asking here is, what do our estate planning documents provide? And this is really less of a question for Anne to ask and more of a mandate to be fully engaged in that estate planning review process, right? So that Anne really understands how the estate planning documents work and her rights to them, under them. So I have listed here some of those areas where I often saw women clients when I was an estate planning attorney get into trouble. A couple of examples: probate versus non-probate assets, right? So what assets in particular are disposed of under the will or living trust, right? So no matter how favorable the living trust is or the will with respect to your rights, if the assets under it, right, if the assets disposed under it are not those assets that you expect to be disposed under it, it's not going to do you any good. And certain assets are not disposed of under a living trust or a will, right? Like life insurance, like retirement plan, like retirement plans. So it's very important to understand what exactly is disposed of under the estate plan documents. Another big issue, liquidity, especially when it comes to the family home, right? Or a vacation home that's important to you. If you get that house willed to you or just given to you under the living trust, is there sufficient liquidity to pay the expenses on that house? That was an area where I often saw, you know, husband leaves wife, their vacation home in Laguna Beach, that's worth $10, $15 million, but not enough liquid funds to pay the expenses, and then wife is forced to sell that home. So understanding the estate planning documents at a deeper level, not just what the summary says. Another big area here is who gets what, right? If half of Joe's assets go to the kids upon his death and half of Joe's assets go to Anne, that's great. That may be what Anne agreed to, but who gets to decide what that 50% share is made of, right? Who gets to decide which assets go to which share? That's often a more important discussion than the actual percentage share each beneficiary is entitled to. So all of these are issues that a really good estate planning attorney should be addressing anyways, but just identifying them ahead of a meeting with the estate planning attorney and your financial advisor is a great way to get a jump on some of these issues that are going to be open for discussion and could become important down the line. Next concern. So Anne now understands who owns what, who owes what. She knows what would happen to their assets, Joe's assets, upon Joe's death. But Anne realizes that now she doesn't have a lot of visibility into their balance sheet, right? So now we're getting more into the investment side of things, right? She's particularly in the dark when it comes to Joe's retirement accounts, as well as their family investment account, which Joe manages. Anne's concerned that if Joe were to die suddenly, she would be left with potentially a bunch of illiquid assets, right? Because he owns this big business, right? That's the majority of his wealth. And she's concerned that to maintain her current lifestyle, she'd be forced to delay her own retirement or potentially sells Joe's interest in their business or their investments at an unfavorable price because she needs liquidity. So the question Anne should be asking here is, after Joe's death, will I have the appropriate amount and composition of assets to maintain my lifestyle through retirement? So Most importantly, Anne needs to see the family balance sheet, and she needs to understand what that balance sheet is composed of, right? Particularly those accounts or those investment accounts that she is not as familiar with. Then she needs to ask what that same balance sheet and portfolio would look like after Joe's death, whether it's timely or untimely, right? Whether it happens 2 years from now or 20 years from now, taking into consideration all of those various consequences that would flow from Joe's death, right? Life insurance payouts, losing Joe's salary, forced sales of illiquid assets, expenses, taxes, anything like that. And I have, again, just like with the estate planning, some of the specific considerations that Anne should be focusing on here. And again, liquidity is a big one, right? If Anne needs cash immediately upon Joe's death, is there going to be a source from which she can easily get that cash? Will Anne have sufficient income to support herself, even if she lives for 20 or 30 years beyond Joe? What is Anne's interest in Joe's retirement account? That becomes more important the bigger Joe's retirement account is. And there's a lot of shifting and changing in that space because of the SECURE Act, right? That big piece of legislation that took effect last year that's really affected the tax treatment and planning around inherited IRAs. So those conversations around retirement plan assets, especially for people who have substantial retirement assets, is a very big concern right now, and it's often overlooked. And then finally, does the composition of their investment portfolio account for the possibility of Joe's untimely death, right? It may assume that Joe lives for another 20 years, but what happens if Joe doesn't, right? Will it need to be adjusted? Is it in a flexible enough position where it accounts for that possibility? And just like with when we were doing the analysis of who owns what and who owes what, based on what Anne finds out, there may be some adjustment that Anne needs to make, right? Or that they need to make to the composition of their portfolio, to their retirement plan beneficiary designations. They may need to shore up some of the documentation around these assets, as well as make different decisions around their investments. So in addition to addressing her concerns over Joe's assets, right? Anne also needs to better understand what would happen to her assets. So what would her rights and obligations be upon a divorce? So remember, Anne also is a successful professional, and she also has that trust that she inherited from her father. So Joe has received a substantial salary from his business for most of their marriage. But in the last few years, he hasn't taken much of one in an effort to help his business grow. So as a result, Anne and Joe have been living off of Anne's salary, right? Paying the majority of the family expenses with just her income. And they've also periodically drawn from Anne's trust, so that irrevocable trust her father left her, to pay for family expenses. So Anne's concerned, and she really has a right to be concerned, that if they were to get divorced because of their reliance recently on her salary, and their reliance or their tendency to draw from her trust fund during their marriage, she could have alimony obligations to Joe, right? And this is absolutely a valid concern based on the facts at hand. So the question Anne should be asking here is, what is Joe's claim to my income and assets in the event of divorce? So as I said, Anne is right to pay attention to who is paying family expenses and from what source. The facts matter in this type of analysis. So Anne needs to understand how these facts will impact her potential alimony obligations, right? Under local law, both with respect to her income and her trust. And based on the facts we described, Joe could very easily claim that he is entitled to alimony from Anne, even though he has substantial assets of his own. Now, he may not win that argument, but Anne is still going to have to fight it if Joe brings it up upon a divorce, right? And even with respect to her trust, and this is probably the scariest one, I think, which doesn't even technically belong to Anne, right? She doesn't have a right to anything from the trust. Joe could make the claim that the trust funds should be taken into account in determining if Anne has alimony obligations and the extent of these obligations. That's a very scary prospect if you have inherited assets that are your family's, that are to remain in your family, right? But if you've been using distributions from that trust to pay marital expenses, or pay for, you know, school tuition for your children, college tuition, there is an argument then can be made that those trust funds should be considered when determining an alimony obligation. So there's a lot of potential liability here for Ann. And even if Joe weren't going to win those arguments, right? They may be weak arguments. Ann is still going to have to fight them, which is a burden in itself. And so what helps mitigate the risk here is talking about intent and then documenting intent, right? Having both spouses sign documents that reflect that the trust is Ann's separate property. And should they use money from the trust to add on an addition to their joint home, that is not because Ann is converting anything from the trust to their community or marital assets, right? Any type of agreement that reflects intent as to the treatment of that property, right? It's often called something like a postnuptial agreement, is helpful in those instances down the line when you do have a divorce. And even in the case of death. So these discussions are not easy to have. It's unpleasant topics, but it's much easier to do when, tempers are calm, not in the heat of the moment. And I saw this play out several times when I practiced. So always better to have these discussions now to agree and then reflect intent and document it, right? No matter how hard that discussion is currently. All right. So Ann wants to understand her potential obligations when it comes to a divorce, but because Joe's wealth is primarily his business, she's also hoping to understand her default rights upon divorce or Joe's death as it relates to his assets, particularly his business. And she understands that since Joe came into the marriage with his business interest, right, it's generally not going to be considered marital or community property in the event of a divorce or death. So, and therefore wouldn't be subject to that 50-50 division, right? For those of you in California, upon divorce or death, community property, unless it's specified otherwise, is subject to that 50%, right? But Joe's business interest, because he came into the marriage with it, is not likely to be considered community property, right? What would be considered community property is Joe's compensation income that he earns as salary. So Joe's compensation income has fluctuated over the years, as we said, and Ann knows he's put a substantial amount of assets into the business during their marriage too, right? So Ann's concerned that simply being entitled to one half of Joe's compensation income, right, earned during their marriage, if they were to get divorced, would not be representative of her actual legal rights, but she's really unsure if she has any claim to Joe's equity interest in his business because he came into the marriage with it. So it's not technically community property. So the question Ann should be asking is, what are my rights to Joe's interest in the business upon divorce or Joe's death? So Ann, again, needs to understand what her default rights would be. She also needs to understand what type of value she's talking about, right? How valuable is Joe's interest in the business? Most likely, Ann's going to have a claim to one half of Joe's compensation income during the marriage, right? We mentioned that. But for many reasons, Ann could also have a claim to his equity interest in the business, even though it's not technically community property. So, for example, if Joe's compensation income would have been higher, but for his partner's management decisions, right? So this idea that they were going to keep money in the business, so not take a salary, Ann could have a claim to a portion of his equity. Or if Joe had contributed joint assets or some of their community property to the business at any point, Ann could have a claim to the equity interest, right? So it's first understanding if Ann does have a claim, and then again, it's documenting, right? So once she establishes that she could be entitled to a portion of Joe's interest upon divorce, she needs to understand what her rights and obligations would be under the partnership agreement, under the governing documents, the LLC agreement, right? She needs to understand if she would have be forced to sell her interest, assuming she has an equity interest. So there's a lot of digging to be done. And then again, you may have to adjust the documentation to reflect intent. And just like with Ann's property, these are tough conversations to have, but it's always best to document intent now, whether that's through a postnuptial agreement, through some type of community property or separate property agreement, adding Ann in as a partner now so that she's reflected as an equity owner. All sorts of ways to do this. Your estate planning attorney, tax professional, financial advisor are going to have ways to do this, But the most important thing is to have these conversations while tempers are in control and before things get really contentious, should there be a divorce. All right, and last concern here, and I always hesitate whether to include this one, but I do think it's incredibly important because of the stakes, right? This is a high stakes issue. So Anne's concerned with Joe's tax returns. So throughout their marriage, Joe has handled the relationship with their accountant, as we said at the beginning. Anne has always signed their joint tax returns without reviewing them, right? Without speaking to the tax preparer. And I know a lot of us are guilty of this. Anne knows that Joe and his partners have maybe taken some aggressive but not unreasonable positions on their tax returns. And Anne's concerned about her potential liability in the event that the IRS were to determine that Joe was liable for back taxes, right? Interest or penalties, particularly if that determination were made after a divorce or Joe's death. So the question Anne should be asking, am I comfortable with the contents of my joint tax return? So Anne should never, ever sign a tax return without understanding its contents. And this may seem like a chore and a really dry one at that, but if Anne signs her name on a return, she is certifying that she agrees with the positions taken in that return and assumes the accompanying potential liability. So if things go sideways, there are defenses available to her, right? That innocent spouse defense, I'm sure some of us have heard of, but these are incredibly difficult to use. They apply in only a very, very limited circumstance. And the burden of proving that you qualify for one of those exemptions or one of those defenses is very, very high, no matter how ridiculous or bad the facts are with respect to Joe or the spouse involved in the fact situation at hand. So Anne's main takeaway here is to use the meeting with their accountant as an opportunity to establish her own relationship with the accountant, express her concerns, and really understand if she is comfortable with the levels of risk being taken in the return, considering her own potential liability, right? Because if they get divorced, Joe goes bankrupt, who are they going to come after, right? If Joe is liable for back taxes or penalty, let me tell you, they are going to come after Anne. So it is incredibly important that Anne understand what she's getting into by signing those tax returns. All right, so Anne has a big job ahead of her, right? Those are a lot of scary situations that Anne wants to avoid. But I hope what you took away from that is that the information that Anne can obtain through these discussions with Joe, with her financial advisor, with their estate planning attorney and their CPA, the information is going to give her the tools to be in control when or if any of these events come to pass, right? So these are the questions that Anne should start with, what we just went over. But remember, Anne's just a hypothetical, right? She's an example of one individual, one set of circumstances. And we tried to give Anne the characteristics that would make her situation relevant, at least in part, to many different women. But really, in the end, everybody's situation is completely unique. And this is why the relationships with advisors and professionals, right? Attorneys, accountants, financial advisors is so important. No list of questions that I give you is going to supplant the benefits and the guidance that a trusted advisor who understands your personal and family situations, goals, concerns, that guidance that they can give you. So if you walk away with one action item here, it's to establish and foster a relationship of your own, right? Not just as a couple, but of your own, independent from your spouse, with each of those professionals and advisors that you work with. All right, Elliot, I am going to turn it back to you for some questions.
Great. Thank you very much. Leslie, that was terrific. We appreciate you doing this. Again, Leslie Geller of the Capital Group, that's a $1 trillion plus strategic partner of ours based in LA. American Funds is how the consumer would know this company. I just have a handful of questions for you, not overly complicated, but let's talk about the intent versus the reality on a living trust. And we're going to wipe the husband out first. And I'm sorry to everybody listening, but in our industry, we always wipe the husband out first. So the question is, the second marriage couple, third marriage, doesn't really matter. that there are children from each marriage. And they've now come together and they now have a nice, terrific marriage. Everybody again seems to get along. They've decided that, you know, to be fair, we've combined our assets. We've done these things. Let's leave everything to the kids. And, you know, and we're gone. We'll pick one or two of them as co-trustees, co-executors, just to be fair, one from each side, whatever. Except that when the husband dies, the children no longer get along. And it turns out they didn't have the best relationship with their stepmother or stepfather, if she dies first. And there starts to be some game playing between the children, the parents, and that belongs to me. No, that belongs to me. So what are the recourse? Let's go to the surviving spouse. Let's take her as her surviving spouse with the man passing away. And she's not doing well with his children. His children aren't doing well with her. But there are assets involved. And, you know, money breeds greed and people want their fair share and claws are coming out. So what happens now?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, before we get into what happens now, I think ideally it's always best to address the situation before anybody dies, right? And my default was always, yeah, I get that everybody gets along. That's wonderful. But exactly like you said, Elliot, things change, particularly when the patriarch or matriarch passes away, right? And you lose that unifying presence, right? Things often get more complicated. And so I would always urge clients in these types of blended family situations, no matter how well you think everyone gets along, keep things separate, right? Keep things as separate as possible, not just the assets themselves, but keep everybody's hands out of everybody else's business, right? So like we talked about with Anne, the Joe's son from his first marriage should not be trustee of Anne's trust, right? That is just a disaster in the making, right? It's much better to have an independent person in there. It's much better to have an institution in there. It's not good to mix those interests. But assuming that you didn't get to address that before, you know, patriarch dies, right? And you're left with this messy situation. It's really just about doing what you can, again, to separate things as much as possible, right? And sometimes that's harder to do after the fact, but hopefully within that trust document, the wife has the ability to remove and replace the trustee. Right. And so if you can have it, so the child from husband's first marriage is not the trustee of her trust, right? If you can make sure that you deal with some of the issues through funding, right? So to make sure that the kids get what the kids are going to use and the spouse gets what the spouse is going to use, and you don't have a 50% interest of the home in the spouse's trust and a 50% interest in the kids' trust, right? So you can deal with some of these issues, I think, through funding, right? And keeping things separate. But a lot of times it's about the identity of the trustees, right? And it's about coming to an agreement with who is going to be in charge. And maybe it does make sense for everybody to step back in an institution to take over, particularly if there's a lot of money involved and some complex dynamics. But the main goal for everybody should be staying out of court because that's not good for anyone. And that's not always possible, but it doesn't do anyone any good to spend the money from the trust on court expenses and lawyer bills and mediators. And so sometimes you can get cooler heads to prevail in that way, but this is a tricky situation. So as I said, it's always best to try to deal with these issues to the extent you can before either spouse passes away.
Okay, let's a question about assuming there's no divorce here and we're on our first marriage. It's a long-term marriage, 40 plus years, and they're trying to figure out how to have the trust written out. And they both agree, look, we have three children. We want to leave a third to each one of them. Pretty straightforward meat and potatoes type of response. But over the years, they've given a deposit to one of them for a down payment on a house. Another one was starting a business. maybe that business succeeded or failure, but that was another chunk of dollars. The third child asked for nothing, got nothing that they needed, and you know, there's no financial burden that they placed on their parents. But now they're trying to figure out how to be fair and how to be equal, and they're not the same. So how do you explain the difference of fair and equal in a way that doesn't alienate children?
Right. And the way I explain this to people all the time, right? And that's a very subtle distinction, but it's a big one, right? Equal is very objective. Fair is subjective and depends on the family situation, right? Depends on the family values, on their goals. And so when I would have clients come in and say, we want to treat everybody equally, I would say, okay, do you mean you want to treat everybody equally in terms of everybody gets exactly the same amount? Or do you instead mean that you want to be fair, right? Based on what you think your children to get should get, their needs, et cetera. Oftentimes, they didn't mean equal, they meant fair. Because children do have different needs, right? And grandchildren are going to have different needs based on their professions, based on if they get married, based on who they marry, based on the area, the country they live in. And if a client really did want to treat children equally, right? They did want each child to receive an equal amount, right? Including taking into account all of the giving that was done during life. There are easy ways to do that, right? You have equalization provisions in the trust that say upon death, all three kids get equal shares, but those shares are adjusted based on lifetime gifts, right? And here's a schedule of lifetime gifts that were made that should be used in those calculations. So there's really easy ways to address that equality. But even when we would do it that way, we would try to provide enough flexibility within those equal shares to account for what could happen down the road, different financial circumstances, right? And you can do that through distribution provisions, through trustee provisions. But we'd really try to impart as much flexibility within those equal shares as possible. Now, most of the time, as I said, clients didn't mean they wanted to treat everybody equally. They meant they wanted to treat their children fairly, right? So the child who married the heir to a billion-dollar fortune didn't need an equal share of this estate, right? And so they would adjust the shares accordingly. And the most important thing when that was the case was communication, right? Making sure that all of the children understood why the decisions were being made to treat certain children one way and certain children the other way, right? And sometimes in that case, you could still get around it by, let's say, you know, you have that same child who marries somebody who is inheriting on their own a big fortune, right? So they don't need any of their parents' estate, right? You could skip them and leave everything to the grandchildren, right? So you're not providing anything for the child directly, you're providing for the grandchildren. There's a lot of different ways around it. But I think, Elliot, you're completely right in you first want to understand whether you mean truly do you want to treat children equally, or do you really just want to treat them fairly based on their individual circumstances and needs? And again, no matter what, I think the most important thing is communicating and making sure that everybody involved understands the intent behind those decisions.
Right. Well, one last question, Leslie, and that is, I want to talk for a second about behavioral finance. So we don't live in a black and white world. Most people are in a world of gray with emotions and feeling good one day, feeling bad another, in between and so forth. And there is a world of difference in our world, the financial world. When you're speaking to a man and speaking to a woman, behavioral finance has very different reactions and very different words that are needed. Attorneys, I know you practice this. When you're speaking to one, speaking to the other, you can't just, they listen sometimes in very different ways. What you said and what is heard are very, very different. And now you start throwing intergenerational behavioral finance in there. Then you have some chips on people's shoulders with, wait, that was my dad, that's mine. Or that was my mother's, that's mine. And you can be misinterpreted in a heartbeat of intent, even with very good intent. So in my business, when I'm talking to husband and wife or any, or you in your business, and I imagine as a lawyer, it wasn't all that different dealing with a couple. What's the best approach to do that to make sure that intent and what everybody's heard is what you meant to be heard?
That's a great question. And I think probably the most direct way I tried to address that when I practiced, particularly when I was representing a couple or a family, was ensuring that I was developing relationships and having conversations both with everybody and then individually with all parties, right? So understanding everyone that I was working with as a unit and how those dynamics worked. And then also understanding, right, how everyone understood things, right, or individual intent through individual interactions and conversations. So not just building a relationship with the wife, because that was easier for me, but making sure that I was having those separate conversations with husband as well, or with children if we were working with them, so that I understood everybody's individual perspective and how they were interpreting what we were talking about. And I hit on this a little bit in the presentation, right? It's about developing those relationships, not just as a couple or a family unit, but as an individual as well. And I don't think you can ensure that everybody is interpreting what you're saying with the intent that you're looking for, right? You can't do that without building those independent relationships. And so I think, again, that's probably the biggest thing there, is not just to see the couple as a unit, right? But to really engage with each of them as an individual, right? And that, you know, can be as simple as emails, right? Or phone conversations, but getting a perspective from the individual and not just the couple or the family.
Well, great. Well, we've been speaking with Leslie Geller, attorney for the Capital Group, and has a master's degree as well from NYU in taxation. Leslie, thank you very much for being part of the show.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for our friends at Capital Group, American Funds, and we'll see you next time.